5. The breaking of the one into the manifold. The forward roll of the cosmogonic round precipitates the one into the many. Herewith a great crisis, a rift, splits the created world into two apparently contradictory planes of being. In Paiore's chart, the people emerge from the lower darkness and immediately go to work to elevate the sky. They are revealed as moving with an apparent independence. They hold councils, they decide, they plan. They take over the work of arranging the world. Yet we know that behind the scenes, the unmoved mover is at work like a puppet master. In mythology, wherever the unmoved mover, the mighty living one, holds the center of attention, there is a miraculous spontaneity about the shaping of the universe. The elements condense and move into play of their own accord, or at the Creator's slightest word. The portions of the self-shattering cosmic egg go to their stations without aid. But when the perspective shifts to focus on living beings, when the panorama of space and nature is faced from the standpoint of the personages ordained to inhabit it, then a sudden transformation overshadows the cosmic scene. No longer do the forms of the world appear to move in the patterns of a living, growing, harmonious thing, but stand recalcitrant, or at best, inert. The props of the universal stage have to be adjusted, even beaten into shape. The earth brings forth thorns and thistles. Man eats bread in the sweat of his brow. Two modes of myth, therefore, confront us. According to one, the demiurgic forces continue to operate of themselves. According to the other, they give up the initiative and even set themselves against the further progress of the cosmogonic round. The difficulties represented in this latter form of myth begin even as early as during the long darkness of the original creature-begetting embrace of the cosmic parents. Let the Maoris introduce us to this terrible theme. Ranji, the sky, lay so close on the belly of Papa, Mother Earth, that the children could not break free from the womb.
They were in an unstable condition, floating about the world of darkness, and this was their appearance. Some were crawling, some were upright with arms held up, some lying on their sides, some on their backs, some were stooping, some with their heads bent down, some with legs drawn up, some kneeling, some feeling about in the dark. They were all within the embrace of Rangi and Papa. At last, the beings who had been begotten by heaven and earth, worn out by the continued darkness, consulted among themselves, saying, "Let us now determine what we should do with Rangi and Papa, whether it would be better to slay them or to rend them apart." Then spake to Matawanga, the fiercest of the children of heaven and earth, "It is well. Let us slay them." Then spake Tane Mahuta, the father of the forests and of all things that inhabit them, or that are constructed from trees, "Nay, not so. It is better to rend them apart, and to let the heaven stand far above us, and the earth lie under our feet. Let the sky become a stranger to us, but the earth remain close to us as our nursing mother."
Several of the brother gods vainly tried to rend apart the heavens and the earth. At last, it was Tane Mahuta himself, the father of the forests and of all things that inhabit them, or that are constructed from trees, who succeeded in the titanic project.
"His head is now firmly planted on his mother, the earth. His feet he raises up and rests against his father, the skies. He strains his back and limbs with mighty effort. Now are rent apart, Rangi and Papa, and with cries and groans of woe they shriek aloud. Wherefore slay you thus your parents? Why commit you so dreadful a crime as to slay us, as to rend your parents apart?" But Tane Mahuta pauses not. He regards not their shrieks and cries. Far, far beneath him, he presses down the earth. Far, far. far above him, he thrusts up the sky.
As known to the Greeks, this story is rendered by Hesiod in his account of the separation of Uranus, Father Heaven, from Gaia, Mother Earth. According to this variant, the Titan Cronos castrated his father with a sickle and pushed him up out of the way. In Egyptian iconography, the position of the cosmic couple is inverted. The sky is the mother, the father is the vitality of the earth. But the pattern of the myth remains. The two were pushed asunder by their child, the air god Shu. Again, the image comes to us from the ancient cuneiform texts of the Sumerians, dating from the 3rd and 4th millennia BC. First was the primeval ocean. The primeval ocean generated the cosmic mountain, which consisted of heaven and earth united. An, the heaven father, and Ki, the earth mother, produced Enlil, the air god, who presently separated An from Ki, and then himself united with his mother to beget mankind. But if these deeds of the desperate children seem violent, they are as nothing compared with the total carving up of the parent power, which we discover recorded in the Icelandic Eddas and in the Babylonian Tablets of Creation. The final insult here is given in the characterization of the demiurgic presence of the abyss as evil, dark, obscene. The bright young warrior sons, now disdaining the generative source, the personage of the seed state of deep sleep, summarily slay it, hack it, slice it into lengths, and carpenter it into the structure of the world. This is the pattern for victory of all our later slayings of the dragon, the beginning of the age-long history of the deeds of the hero. The poetic Edda is a collection of 34 Old Norse poems treating of the pagan Germanic gods and heroes. The poems were composed by a number of singers and poets, skalds, in various parts of the Viking world, one at least in Greenland, during the period AD 900 to 1050. The collection was completed, apparently, in Iceland. The Prose Edda is a handbook for young poets written in Iceland by the Christian master poet and chieftain Snorri Sturluson, 1178 to 1241. It summarizes the pagan Germanic myths and reviews the rules of skaldic rhetoric. The mythology documented in these texts reveals an earlier peasant stratum associated with the thunderer Thor, a later aristocratic stratum, that of Votan Othin, and a third distinctly phallic complex, Njörth, Freya, and Frey. Bardic influences from Ireland mingle with classical and oriental themes in this profoundly brooded, yet grotesquely humorous world of symbolic forms. According to the Eddic account, Gnungagap is the void, the abyss of chaos into which all devolves at the end of the cycle, twilight of the gods, and out of which then all appears again after a timeless age of reincubation. After the yawning gap had given forth in the north a mist world of cold, and in the south a region of fire, and after the heat from the south had played on the rivers of ice that crowded down from the north, a yeasty venom began to be exuded. From this a drizzle arose, which in turn congealed to rime. The rime melted and dripped. Life was quickened from the drippings in the form of a torpid, gigantic, hermaphroditic, horizontal figure named Ymir. The giant slept, and as it slept it sweated. One of its feet begat with the other a son, while under its left hand germinated a man and wife. The rime continually melted and dripped, and there condensed from it the cow, Adumla. From her udder flowed four streams of milk, which were drunk for nourishment by Ymir. But the cow, for her own nourishment, licked the ice blocks, which were salty. The evening of the first day she licked, a man's hair came forth from the blocks. The second day, a man's head. The third, the entire man was there, and his name was Buri. Now Buri had a son, the mother is not known, named Bor, who married one of the giant daughters of the creatures that had sprung from Ymir. She gave birth to the trinity of Othin, Vili, and Ve, and these then slaughtered sleepful Ymir and carved the body into chunks.
Of Ymir's flesh the earth was fashioned, and of his sweat the sea. Crags of his bones, trees of his hair, and of his skull the sky. Then of his bones the blithe gods made Midgard for sons of men, and of his brain the bitter-mooded clouds were all created.
In the Babylonian version, the hero is Marduk, the sun god. The victim is Tiamat, terrifying, dragon-like, attended by swarms of demons, a female personification of the original abyss itself. Chaos as the mother of the gods, but now the menace of the world. With bow and trident, club and net, and a convoy of battle winds, the god mounted his chariot. The four horses, trained to trample underfoot, were flecked with foam.
But Tiamat turned not her neck. With lips that failed not, she uttered rebellious words. Then the Lord raised the thunderbolt, his mighty weapon, and against Tiamat, who was raging, thus he sent the word. Thou art become great, thou hast exalted thyself on high, and thy heart hath prompted thee to call to battle, and against the gods my fathers thou hast contrived thy wicked plan. Let then thy host be equipped, let thy weapons be girded on. Stand, I and thou, let us join battle. When Tiamat heard these words, she was like one possessed. She lost her reason. Tiamat uttered wild, piercing cries. She trembled and shook to her very foundations. She recited an incantation. She pronounced her spell, and the gods of the battle cried out for their weapons. Then advanced Tiamat and Marduk, the counselor of the gods. To the fight they came on, to the battle they drew nigh. The Lord spread out his net and caught her, and the evil wind that was behind him he let loose in her face. The terrible winds filled her belly, and her courage was taken from her, and her mouth she opened wide. He seized the trident and burst her belly. He severed her inward parts. He pierced her heart. He overcame her and cut off her life. He cast down her body and stood upon it.
Having then subdued the remainder of her swarming host, the god of Babylon returned to the mother of the world.
And the Lord stood upon Tiamat's hinder parts, and with his merciless club he smashed her skull. He cut through the channels of her blood, and he made the north wind bear it away into secret places. Then the Lord rested, gazing upon her dead body, and devised a cunning plan. He split her up like a flat fish into two halves. One half of her he established as a covering for heaven. He fixed a bolt, he stationed a watchman, and bade them not to let her waters come forth. He passed through the heavens, he surveyed the regions thereof, and over against the deep he set the dwelling of Nudimud, and the Lord measured the structure of the deep.
Marduk, in this heroic manner, pushed back with a ceiling the waters above, and with a floor the waters beneath. Then, in the world between, he created man. The myths never tire of illustrating the point that conflict in the created world is not what it seems. Tiamat, though slain and dismembered, was not thereby undone. Had the battle been viewed from another angle, the chaos monster would have been seen to shatter of her own accord, and her fragments move to their respective stations. Marduk and his whole generation of divinities were but particles of her substance. From the standpoint of those created forms, all seemed accomplished as by a mighty arm, amid danger and pain. But from the center of the emanating presence, the flesh was yielded willingly, and the hand that carved it was ultimately no more than an agent of the will of the victim herself. Herein lies the basic paradox of myth, the paradox of the dual focus. Just as at the opening of the cosmogonic cycle, it was possible to say, God is not involved, but at the same time, God is creator, preserver, destroyer. So now, at this critical juncture, where the one breaks into the many, destiny happens, but at the same time is brought about. From the perspective of the source, the world is a majestic harmony of forms, pouring into being, exploding, and dissolving. But what the swiftly passing creatures experience is a terrible cacophony of battle cries and pain. The myths do not deny this agony, the crucifixion. They reveal within, behind, and around it, essential peace, the heavenly rose. The shift of perspective from the response of the central cause to the turbulation of the peripheral effects is represented in the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They ate of the forbidden fruit, and the eyes of them both were opened. The bliss of paradise was closed to them, and they beheld the created field from the other side of a transforming veil. Henceforth, they should experience the inevitable as the hard to gain.